Welcome to Politically Enraged, the Lefties Refuge. Politically Enraged is a podcast purpose-built to discuss British and international disunity in political spaces, talk through ideas, introduce you to amazing people, and fight back against authoritarianism. My name is David Moo, I'm your host, and I hope you'll stick with us. Follow our Twitter at Political Rages, find us on Instagram and Ko-fi at Politically Enraged, and let's speak truth to power. Welcome to Politically Enraged, the Lefties Refuge. It is your usual host, David Moo, and I'm being joined today by one of my favourite TikTok creators, Open Bookshelf, who I have admired from afar for a really long time. And it turns out that we were doing the same thing to each other, which I find hilarious. Abby is an absolute genius and her videos are fantastic. You should check her out. But here she is today to talk to me about British authoritarianism and that as a wider subject. So take it away, Abby.
Sounds kind of ominous already, doesn't it?
It does, and I love it.
So, I figured I should probably introduce myself a bit kind of formally. Yeah, so I'm a PhD candidate at a university in Germany, which means I like spend my life surrounded by far more coherently lefty leftists than myself. So people who are actually able to like study socialist theory in all kinds of contexts, even while they're getting a degree in biosciences, which is mad, but apparently that's how it is here. That's because here, unlike in our lovely country, higher education is free. So in fact, if you come from a lower income background, they actually pay you to go to university. In fact, if you were British up until Brexit, it was also free for us, in case you wanted another reason to hate how little we were told about what leaving the EU meant, especially what it takes from us.
I actually just felt a rock drop into my stomach because the idea of doing that is amazing. And now I can't. Thank you. Thank you so much for the people that voted for this. It's fine. I'm fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's still way cheaper. So instead of spending like 20 grand on a master's, like what you would have to do in the UK right now, it's like 3 grand a year. So 6 grand, still cheaper if you wanted to. Just saying. Not trying to pressure you to come to Germany or anything, but anyway. Yeah, so my PhD is in modern authoritarianism, specifically Chinese authoritarianism, which means I spend like my life buried in Chinese policy documents. It's a great life, gotta say. And the more that I learn about the brilliantly creative ways that the Chinese navigate getting what they want under authoritarianism, the more I think that we as British people need to start accepting that we live in a system that is only free and fair for some of us. And for the rest of us, it's kind of, yeah, not so much. And we need to accept that so that we can start collectively forming strategies to make sure that we get what we need out of the system, especially if that system's going to get worse before it gets better. So hence fangirling over everything that you do.
I really appreciate it. But I think it's interesting that you say it in that way, because, you know, if you've been following me for a while, you'll have seen the journey that I've taken, where I started off just, you know, doing stupid videos and then making fun of Boris Johnson and then starting to talk a little bit about the ridiculous stuff that was happening. And I went through, I think I've gone through every phase it's possible to go through, because originally I was like, overthrow the whole bally lot of them. And then, you know, the thing is, it's difficult because I've had to temper myself, because as much as I agree that we need radical overhaul, what I'm frightened of, and I say this to everyone who is the same, I'm always like, radical overhaul is great, except for the people it's not great for. And it's all well and good being like, let's turn the country into a socialist paradise. I'm like, if you tear apart a system as embedded as capitalism in the UK, inevitably, it will take a long time to set up an alternative, and people will suffer and will die. And I'm not that desperate to fundamentally revolutionize. I would rather work within the system and try and change it. And that's kind of where my head's at the minute. Whether it will change again as things progress, I don't know. But what you're saying is stuff that I've been thinking more and more and more on for a long time. And it's good to know that someone that's like incredibly intelligent thinks the same, because I've just kind of sit there sometimes and I go, am I just insane? Is that what's happening now?
I mean, I'm not necessarily intelligent, but I am kind of well-educated. Thank you, Germany, again. got to make that point in there, because I'm going to say some stupid stuff, I'm sure, throughout this podcast episode. But you know, just tempering that. Yeah, like I agree. I think especially as a woman, it's kind of difficult to be all about the violent revolution, as much as it, like, you know, I still tear up at the Hunger Games. It's easy to get behind that kind of revolutionary aesthetic. And I got into trouble with quite a lot of Marxists on TikTok for being like, not really a fan of this like violent revolution stuff. But actually, it doesn't work. Not necessarily. I mean, if you violently overhaul a system, the only way that it can go after that is authoritarianism. I mean, statistically, I mean, if you look at comparative studies of authoritarianism around the world, like in an academic sense, it's just the way the cookie crumbles kind of thing. And I genuinely think that if we prepare for the worst, so if we prepare that we are moving towards authoritarianism, we need to survive it. I think that we can still hope that there are people who are smart enough to make policy decisions that overhaul the entire system. But I think coming from the kind of background that you and I do, whether or not we sound like we come from that kind of background anymore is another issue, but we can't really afford to not prepare for the worst. And I know for my family, like, this cost of living crisis is like, it's insane how much more people living in Britain are having to pay every yep. year. And I mean, I remember my mom saying to me once that at the end of each week, she had 5p extra after she'd budgeted in everything that we absolutely needed. And that sat with me for so long since, like, that she did that all alone, you know, as a single mom. And how many people in the UK right now are doing that, like getting by on 5p extra at the end of each week? Like, that's nuts. And we can't really afford to either take time off to protest or to get politically engaged. So there's got to be ways that we can get what we want and need without having to invest the time needed to engage politically. Like, we can't go and work for an NGO for free for 5 years to get a job with them and be able to advocate for ourselves. Like, it's not possible. We can't quit our jobs to go do Fridays for Future for an afternoon, you know, like, especially not if you're on an hourly wage. So trying to find ways to get politically engaged in a system that maybe doesn't necessarily silence our voices explicitly, but absolutely tries to underrepresent them as much as it possibly can, that's kind of hard to navigate. And it can be really demoralizing too.
Exactly. I think it's been interesting watching some of the ministers that get wheeled out recently, because obviously they've been doing the F-tier ones because they've had to go and face questions about Partygate, etc. But they had Jacob Rees-Mogg on LBC. I don't know if you saw that. We're unfortunate enough to see that, should I say. And just the deftness with which that man can wave around any responsibility for even his own words, you know. We all know that Jacob Rees-Mogg is the man who said that, who essentially implied that people who walked back into Grenfell Tower were stupid, despite the fact that they were told to do that by the firemen, you know. And the guy who was on LBC with him said, you know, why is it that you think that you can imply that Partygate is just fluff? And he was like, well, you see, there's a war in Ukraine and all of this. And it's like I've said, I would never, ever, ever want to come across as callous towards anything that's happening elsewhere in the world. What's happening in Ukraine is terrible. But that guy's broken leg does not mean that my broken wrist doesn't hurt. And that's what's going on at the minute. It's a different problem. Is it a lesser problem than a war? Of course it is. But this is the same radio station where last Wednesday they had a woman on who was like, I've turned off the boiler. I send my children to bed in jumpers. I can't afford anything more than one meal a day. And that is the reality of some people's lives. And I am so privileged to do what I'm doing. I was working for a job that paid fairly decent. And I just looked around at how it was impacting the NHS, which is a socialised healthcare system. And I went, my wage is wholly paid by basically, it's something akin to extorting the NHS. I am not doing this anymore. And I just went, bye, left it. I've got a different job now, which is funded by doing decent things. And I'm also helping kind of reform the NHS's strategy around revalidating doctors, which is really cool. But I also have the time to focus on this. And I think the amount of privilege that comes with that cannot be understated. Every day I wake up and I go, you lucky, lucky sod. Like, you get to sit and you get to read the books that you want to read and you get to write about what you want to write about and never forget that you did this. Like, and how lucky you are to have done that. Because there's so many people that just don't, and they don't even get the chance to think about it. They get up, they go to work, that money goes into their bank, it goes straight out of their bank, they go to bed, they get up and repeat. And it's just madness. And they're the people that I make my content for. Like every day when I wake up, I'm like, what can I say that's going to reach out to one of those people who might just have 5 minutes at work and they're scrolling through TikTok and I pop up? What can I say to them that's like, do you honestly think that you deserve to subsist in a system that tells you that this is the natural order, that you deserve this, while they'll order £600 worth of champagne to Downing Street a month? No, you deserve more than that. That is my whole ethos and pathos. That's it.
I can absolutely relate to this. Like every time I walk into my office at the university, I'm just like, how the hell did I get here? And my first sort of instinct, especially when I was offered a PhD position, you know, that's kind of a huge deal for me, at least. As soon as I got that, I thought, okay, like, how am I going to use this to like pay it back kind of thing? Like, how can I take this knowledge, which is so heavily gatekept? Like, I mean, just look at the cost of an academic journal. If you wanted to buy like one to look at an article, or even if you just wanted to buy one article, it's like 36 euros mm-hmm. for one article. You know, this whole industry that I've suddenly kind of accidentally got into is so heavily gatekept, and this knowledge is sort of kept behind lock and key, kept behind paywalls. And the first instinct that I had, because I know how frustrating it is to want to know stuff, to want to figure out how this system works, because we're impacted by it every single day. Like the system dictates every single aspect of our life, regardless of how much you earn, regardless of what kind of, like if you're born into a councillor state or if you're born into a councillor house, you know, like it dictates every aspect of your existence. And yet we aren't expected to know, or we're not wanted to know how it works at all. And like you were just saying about this Jacob Rees-Mogg thing, how he's able to deflect and send it on kind of thing, the responsibility. This happens with authoritarianism all the time. As soon as you bring up like, actually this bill that Parliament are trying to introduce right now, or that the Tories are trying to introduce right now, is authoritarian in its absolute nature, suddenly you get this whole thing where it's like, oh, but you know, we don't live in a country where they censor books, or we don't live in a country where they have a death penalty, or we don't live in China where they have a one-party rule kind of thing. Like I get this a lot as a China specialist, especially, but it's, you know, there's a reason why we are a democracy and other states around the world are considered authoritarian, you know? And it's, again, this kind of cognitive dissonance, this way of putting the bad thing on somewhere else, like, oh, there's a war going on out there, at least that's not happening to you in nice Britain, you know? This sense of categorizing the other as something bad in order to portray ourselves as good, like, it's not difficult to see like the parallels between this language of democracy versus authoritarianism and the language that went before it of civilization versus the savages used by European colonialists around the world. You know, Europeans and especially the British have this convenient habit of categorizing the other as something negative when they themselves are often worse than what they're promoting as the category on the other side. Like Europeans conveniently categorized communities all over the world as in need of our civilizing influence, while we literally lived with pigs, and while our elite were literally spending weeks unwashed in court, gorging themselves and shitting where they stood. You know, like, I can't think of a better analogy of this whole democracy authoritarianism debate. Like we talk about how the British Empire bought healthcare to civilizations around the world, just like the Romans once bought roads to us, while at the same time washing your hands as an English surgeon was a controversial topic at the time, you know, like in the 1800s. And then it was a former colonized subject, I think it was a Scottish guy, who was like less than or other than the English, who finally convinced the English establishment to wash their bloody hands. So aside from being dirty bastards, yeah, like we have this tendency to use our military-backed power, because we are a nuclear state, to set up like norms and institutions with the express purpose of making ourselves look good and finding some kind of other that we can juxtapose ourselves to. Like in the authoritarianism context, I mean, where are the major indexes of what democracy is? Where are they based? Who are the scholars? Who are the think tanks that are contributing to these definitions? I mean, Freedom House is funded by the US government. The Economist Democracy Index is based in the UK, I think it's in London. And the index that I use, I talked about it recently on TikTok, it's called the Bertelsmann's Transformation Index, and that's based in Germany. You know, and these are the people who are defining what democracy and authoritarianism is. And, you know, they conveniently exclude Western Europe, Northern America, Australia, New Zealand. Like, they conveniently exclude certain countries which have certain common features from these indexes of authoritarianism. I don't know, I say all of this as like, as an academic, like I've studied post-colonial theory and everything, but like, even as just a normal, real British person, I feel this disconnect. I feel this, oh, well, your struggle doesn't count because there's something on the other side of the world or on the other side of the country that is so much worse than your situation. And who does that serve at the end of the day? Like, who is benefiting from that disconnect? Who is benefiting from that, oh, don't look here, look over there kind of dynamic? Because it's definitely not us. And I really struggle with that on a personal level.
It's hard. I think when it comes to being told things like that, that it doesn't take into account who you are as an individual as well. Because, for example, I'm a cis man, but I look at the struggle of women and it enrages me. You know, like, I wrote that article about medical misogyny because I've seen myriad examples of it. I didn't go into it in the article. I don't know whether, like, certain things that have happened to people that I love that are immutable and unchangeable happened because of medical misogyny, because women aren't listened to in medicine. And the problem with that kind of, well, I mean, it could be so much worse. Of course it could be worse, but I don't want it to be. And it just drives me to distraction when we're told by our own politicians that, and to the point where it's filtered down, you'll know that this happens. You go through my comments on videos or on posts that I make on Twitter or even my articles, which I put on my website and stuff. And there's people going, that's just the way it is. This is just life. And I just want to, like, reach through the screen and get those people by the shoulders and go, tell me why it has to be this way. Explain to me why you accept this system. Because we're so far into it. It's so, like, wrapped tightly around everything that we do. But that doesn't mean that it's immutable, unchangeable, that we can't ask for better from it. And it's what drives me insane, because it's not even necessarily, you know, you get, there's that side of things where you get people being like, this is the natural order, which I think is a disgusting sentence. Like, I genuinely am offended when people say anything about the natural order, because it's just akin to some really dark things. But then on the other side of things as well, I get a lot of comments of like, well, why bother? They're all the same. And it's like, they aren't all the same. If you dislike the leader of a party or you dislike certain aspects of a party, I get that. I understand that. But to lump all politicians in with they're all the same and so I'm just not going to partake. The privilege that comes with electing not to partake infuriates me, because what that tells me unequivocally is that you don't suffer no matter who wins or loses. You won't suffer if the Tories get in again, and you're fine with that because they don't hurt you. But what about the people they hurt? You have a voice, and every time you vote, you are not just speaking for you. You are meant to, if I understand the idea of, you know, loving your country and wanting the best for it at all, if I understand the root of that, you are meant to look around at everyone around you and go, who will my vote benefit? Not just me, but who will my, like, what will my vote improve the lives of people in this country? And even if it's a smidge, an inch, why on earth would you not do that?
Even if you're being selfish, like, I think selfishness is valid, quite honestly. It's not something that you want to, like, shout about, like, oh yeah, I'm shamelessly selfish kind of thing. But I think selfishness is a very valid reason for doing something politically. And even if you look at it just from a selfish perspective, by not voting, by choosing consciously not to engage, you are contributing to, I call it political apathy. So when you're too tired, you're too exhausted by the system, you just can't be bothered to engage anymore. You create, and there's so many people that are feeling this way, that there's this whole national sense of political apathy then. And that's exactly what leads to a actual, very real authoritarian regime being built. That's exactly how Nazi Germany ended up being built. That's exactly how the democratic rights that were built into the German system at that time were then stripped away piece by piece. And even if you look at it from a selfish, absolutely selfish viewpoint, do you want to live in an authoritarian system? Like, do you want that for yourself? Because if you continue to disengage, if you continue to not voice your interests, your needs, you will be ignored. That's what happened to young people in the UK for so long. The younger demographic was not the most important voting population, older people were, which is why even the Labour Party had to have fairly conservative, especially in an economic sense, policies, because the major voting demographics were not young people, because young people were disillusioned by what politics meant. Young people were struggling, and they might not even be able to make it to the ballot box because they can't get time off work. So when you become disengaged politically, your entire demographic suffers, because the governments in power are no longer going to care about what you think. Why should they? You're not making the effort to go out and vote. Why are they going to bother putting any effort into policies that are going to benefit you? And if your reason for not voting is that you are just exhausted and you can't be fucked, why are they going to cater to what you need? This is your one communication channel. You know, like, we put so much stock into elections in nominally democratic countries, so much stock into elections. If you're not willing to even vote, why would any government in their right mind listen to what you have to say or think about your needs at all? And as a woman, I find this particularly problematic, because there are a lot of women who maybe don't want to vote because they can't bother. I know in my family, I have people like this. Like, it's been a tough working week. Why on earth am I going to get up, go out and vote? You know, I've had heated, heated conversations with women in my family because they were just too exhausted to go and vote. And now we have a government in power that will not recognize misogyny as a hate crime, that will not protect women from being very actually raped, will not protect any victims from being very actually raped, because it's not in their best interest to, because victims stay quiet. And as soon as all of this starts to build up together, you have a system which doesn't bother to listen to anyone, because nobody's bothering to go vote. So why should they? And then they do what they want to the people who give them money. You know, the Tories are funded by a certain demographic, and this certain demographic get what they want because they engage politically. And we don't have those resources. The only resources that normal people have are a vote. And occasionally, if you go and talk to your local MP, but how many of us have actually had a conversation with our local MP? I mean, I know mine came into our school once and was a misogynistic asswipe. And I never wanted to go near him again, because I thought, I don't want to engage with this abhorrent human being who disregarded my friend's very valid questions. She was a politics and governance, I think the A-level was. So she really knew what she was talking about. He took questions from guys who had stuff to ask. She asked the question, and he told her, don't worry your head about it. I don't want to engage with that person. He's been in power for longer than I've had a vote. So it's hard to try and deal with politics outside of your vote. So if you're throwing away that, what else have you got? So even from an absolutely selfish standpoint, not engaging politically, you're hurting yourself and yourself alone.
I think that's the thing. It is a system that propagates hurt, and it drives me to distraction sometimes seeing how disregarded the younger population is, because I think, now don't get me wrong before I say this, I just want to preface this. I think America does a lot of things wrong when it comes to its elections. Please don't assassinate me. But if you look at the way they engage young people from you know, high school, those people are finding their feet politically. They're engaging. Do they like or dislike the president, whether it's right or wrong? You know, the rabid feudalism that came with Trumpism and stuff, that is obviously incorrect. But damn, if those people didn't know who they were going to vote for and why. They cared at a young age about politics. In the UK, and I was less of a victim of this than other people, but I was a victim of it as well. It was like, oh, I'll show up every 5 years and throw my vote in and whatever. It's only kind of over the last sort of decade that I've really started to understand the nuance that comes behind politics. And that's why I hate those people that try and discount it as everyone's the same. Everyone's the same. Like, okay, let's take that as a truth, that most people politically broadly are the same. It fits into exactly what you just said. The reason that they're the same is that they have to please the same goddamn demographic so that they get their vote. Who's going to do the same thing the best, you know? And that's why. So if you want radical change in politics, stop moaning about it and get involved, you know? Like, have your say, tell your politicians, write to your MPs, do the things that make you heard, protest before it's illegal. That's one of the things that has bothered me the most, understandably, I would think, but seeing the country sliding towards the complete normalization of banning of protests, while at the same time we've got Vladimir Putin going, you'd never see us like cancel JK Rowling in our country. And I'm like, you literally kill people that disagree with you. So let's just leave that there, Mr. Cancel Culture. But how can you rail against a man who has the Iron Fist across all of Russia, who had someone arrested for holding up a blank sign. And yet you're fine with that type of law being brought in over here. You know, don't claim that you care about democracy or that you care about the UK if you're willing to see its peoples under a law that means you can't even voice your displeasure.
This is exactly the point, though. The British regime, so not the individual parties, but the British regime itself, so the centre of political power in the UK, I don't know if that can be changed. If you have an election, we have elections regularly and they're free and fair. But can the regime itself actually be changed? You know, there's this regime that benefits from the first past the post system, which, as we've already said, it disproportionately silences us. And at the same time, you have the Conservatives who are very openly trying to reduce our access to the political process. And then you have Labour, who don't actually seem to be willing to put resources into changing the system at all. Rather, they just sit and benefit from it as an opposition, which again keeps them in power, connected to power, adjacent to power. What motivation do they really have? Let's say that our regime is Labour and the Conservatives. What motivation do these two parties have to genuinely bring about any real change? Even for Labour, which is supposed to be the party of the people, whatever, you know, it's supposed to be slightly more left-wing. What genuine motivation does the Labour Party as an entity have to change the system? Because I don't think it has much. And this is where I find myself questioning, and not just from an academic standpoint, so don't quote me on this as an academic, but from a personal standpoint, I wonder if we as people all got together to vote, could we change the regime in this country? And I'm not sure if we could. And we have two parties, we have multiple parties, we have open elections. But can we actually have a peaceful change of power through these institutions? And I find that hugely problematic that I'm even questioning that. Whether or not it's true from an empirical standpoint is another question. But the fact that I even have this in my head as a relatively politically engaged person, that's terrifying in its own right. Like you said, I was disengaged as a young voter too. My first election when I was 18, I copied what my mom voted because I didn't really understand where you were supposed to go to get information about this. I did that for my second election as well. I completely missed the 2011 referendum on getting a reform to the first past the post system. I completely missed that because I had no idea about how politics worked or what proportional representation was. I had never been taught about these absolutely basic level principles that apply to the system that I lived my entire life in. And that's appalling. I was able to get a university degree at Russell Group University, rub shoulders with children of the elite, and yet I had no idea how our political system worked. Now imagine what it's like for people who don't go to uni, who spend 12 hours a day working and come home exhausted. How are we supposed to engage politically when we have no idea how the system works? And the system itself has designed our education so that we have no idea how the system works. Until we start to have comprehensive political education beyond, they call it citizenship, I think, in schools. You know, before we do anything about system overhaul, violent revolution, whatever, we need to educate people about what this system is. How does it work? What's your place in it? What's your responsibility within it? Because it took me until moving to an authoritarian country before I even realized what my role was as a citizen of a democratic country. And that's awful. I'm supposed to be a graduate. I'm supposed to be well-educated. I'm supposed to be all of these things. I didn't have a fucking clue. Luckily, I've now done a master's in political science, so I'm a bit more informed. But even then, you know, how many degrees do you have to get before you can responsibly vote in the UK? It shouldn't be that. It should be, okay, I know exactly where I vote. I know exactly why I vote. I know exactly where to go to get the party manifestos. I don't have to read for 3 hours to get through one manifesto to get the basic points, you know? Where's the accessibility when it comes to engaging in the most basic form of political participation in our country? You know, that's just when we're talking about the vote. This is before we get to the fact that the sitting government is now trying to limit our ability to engage with the vote itself. The vote is the absolute most basic form of political participation, and they're trying to make even that more complicated. How are we supposed to engage in this? How are we supposed to navigate this without taking on the techniques that, for example, Chinese citizens use to navigate their authoritarian system? And suddenly you realize, actually, I don't have that much access to democratic due process. I am not actually that engaged politically, no matter how much I talk about it. the reality of political engagement is appalling. And that's horrible things to say out loud. And I'm sorry that I've just said them.
But it's true, you know, that's the point. And I think it's such a drop in the bucket kind of thing. But that's why I talk in plain terms about politics. And it's why I kind of eschew any more political language on my videos and stuff. I've said it before. It was November. I was arguing with a girl who was talking about how, you know, Labour was shit and her family suffered under Blair and everything. And I was like, look, I'm really sorry. You know, it's really terrible what happened to you. It's awful. And unfortunately, it's the reality that not everybody is looked after by anybody. That's the problem. We need to find the broadest umbrella to cover the most people in a system that's imperfect. That would be true under socialism. It would be true under capitalism. It's true under any system is imperfect. She was like, oh, it's neoliberalism, blah, blah, blah. And I literally, like, as soon as I saw the comment, I saw red and I just replied immediately and was like, don't start with that on this page. Like, the whole point of this page existing now is to reach out to people that don't know what the fucking hell neoliberalism is. They don't give a shit what neoliberalism is. They need to know, if I vote for these people, I'll have money in my pocket. If I vote for these people, I won't. If I vote for these people, the NHS is at threat. If I vote for these people, it's not. That is what I care about. And that's one of the only kind of subversive things I can think to do at the moment. As things move on, I'm working on it. I'm trying to work out how to combat these things more effectively, to reach out to people more, to be more of a problem solver. But right now, it literally feels like it's about subterfuge. It's about doing the little things that you can do to reach out to those people that think that particular way, or that perhaps just don't care. Why would they care? You know, like we've said, you just disincentivize. I remember being younger, and I remember just being like, Lib Dems said they'd make uni free, so I think I'll vote for them.
That was exactly what I did.
I didn't know what I was doing. You know, if I'd have been more politically aware, I would have been like, well, they're clearly only going to do that if they get a majority, and they're not going to get a majority looking at the polls. You know, it's not going to happen. So,
but maybe at that time you didn't know how majorities work in government. I know I didn't. I literally just listened to that one headline, and that was all I had to go on, because I didn't have the time. I was at uni. I was working obscene hours at the same time. How are you supposed to have time to understand what that means? You know,
exactly. I think the problem is as well, as an ex-media student and someone that really laughs when people say that media degrees aren't important because the amount of Marxism I studied and everything, you know, media, I remember 2007 going to university and looking at the world and going, people don't realize that media includes books and that it includes this weird Facebook thing that's just going off everywhere. You know, people don't realize that it's going to swallow us alive. And even as I was at uni, I was watching this technology just racing along like a lion running across the freaking Serengeti. It was like madness just seeing how much it took over. And now here we are, 2022, media just eats your life. Like, you get up in the morning and you've got your alerts on your phone, which is connected to the media. And then you check your social media. And then on the way into work, if you're on the train, you read a piece of media like the newspaper, or you read it on your phone. And then all day you're listening to the radio in the background, which is a form of media talking about things. Media eats your life. And so I'm so thankful for doing that degree, because it taught me how the system works and how media plays a huge role. I remember it. I remember that vote that year for the Lib Dems. And I remember the headlines of, was it Michael Howard? Whatever is the really creepy looking guy. All the like big newspapers were like, this guy looks like a vampire. And I'm like, looking back now, I'm going, how on earth was that a headline? How is it political man looks creepy? How was that a headline? Especially considering we've got a man in charge now who looks like a well-used shoe buffer. But it's just, you look back and you think, this is the level of discourse that we have around politics in the UK, you know? Boris Johnson's got a wobbly tie. Okay, what's his economic policies like?
And how are you supposed to understand economic policy? Because that's the whole, again, a hugely opaque and complex set of policies, you know? And there's this idea that, you know, one thing can't be true and another one is also true. Like, this whole mindset that you can't support one thing that a party, a company, a person does without, you know, cancelling out everything that goes with it, sort of thing. Like, this whole idea that there can't be any nuance in anything. And that's been fed by the way the media presents itself, that we have politically affiliated newspapers, that we have politically motivated newspapers, that we have newspapers that are owned by a very specific selection of the population, a very small minority of the population, some of which aren't even in, based in our country, you know, like we're supposed to be anti-immigrant and everything, but that anti-immigrant sentiment doesn't seem to extend to the wealthy elite who own everything in our country. You know, it's just reserved for poor immigrants. And there's this sense that what we consume on a daily basis can't cater to that. It can't cater to the complexities because either we're too stupid to understand it, which admittedly, yeah, maybe we are. I mean, if you look at my political history, for sure. But at the same time, why is it that we're too stupid to understand it? What has gone before this media that we now consume en masse? What went before that to ensure that we're not educated enough to understand it? You know, why aren't we taught critical thinking as a core subject? Why aren't we taught to question everything as a basic point of our upbringing? You know, why is that? And when you look, not even deeper, it's not, there's nothing deep about this. I mean, this whole anti-expert sentiment that is very catching in the UK right now is precisely that, redirecting this questioning everything, but not against the media, not against the regime, because the mass media is the regime, but you can't separate the two right now. It's being directed against experts instead, individual experts. And that is, as a China specialist, exactly how other regimes in the world silence legitimate concerns. And to sort of turn to a more practical point, I mean, you were talking about you want to be able to present people with options, present people with subversive things that they can do to like deal with this. And how do we get what we want when we live in a de facto authoritarian regime? You know, how do we do anything? Let's say, like, you know, you're someone like you or me, we don't have a corporate lobbying firm behind us. The world of NGOs is kind of mostly made up of very intelligent and well-meaning upper middle class graduates, or at least people who were financially able to volunteer or take unpaid internships for years to get to where they are now. Same for policymaking. Like the vast majority of lobbying firms or think tanks that propose policy solutions are made up of the same sort of demographic, you know? So let's say this world of access to the political process officially is inaccessible to us. So what channels of feedback do we have to let those people who dictate the borders of our entire world know that we need something? What channels do we have? And what I really like about Chinese citizens' approach, so not the Chinese regime itself, but I love Chinese people. I think Chinese citizens are so smart about how they participate in politics and how they navigate this largely opaque system, even within itself. So even local government officials don't really know how the whole system works, you know, and they have to navigate it too. So even members of the regime have to navigate the system. But I think Chinese citizens themselves, the way that they get what they want under an authoritarian system is really smart. And it's because they mix their methods. They don't just protest, you know, they don't just go to a spot with their placards and their banners, and they don't just protest. Like, protest is normally like a last resort, or it's like a spontaneous emotional moment where those involved don't really see any other option and they just need that outlet. And sometimes the regime just lets them have that outlet, because sometimes you just need to scream about something before you realize what you want or need. But if they're not just protesting, what are they doing? And how can we learn from that? You know, like, how can we get a little bit humble and stop sitting here and saying, we live in a democracy, we know what's right, we have the right to vote, we have freedom of speech. Yeah, fine. Let's look at what other countries are doing. Let's look at what the citizens are doing to get what they want in those systems. And let's see if there's any way that we can learn from that and advocate for ourselves. A lot of the time, Chinese citizens are advocating for themselves through official channels. Like, it's not that the regime is completely closed to listening to citizen voices. No regime, authoritarian or democratic, can afford to not listen to what the citizen as a bulk, as a social group, need. So they have, like, they have the complaints and letters department, or if you can't get your local government to listen to you through complaints and letters, then you have this going to Beijing to voice your complaints as an established, sort of formal route to do it. And when that doesn't work, because sometimes the regime just doesn't want to listen to you, citizen organizations have sprung up, made up of normal people who have experience advocating for themselves, or going to Beijing or speaking to the local government. Maybe they just have friends within local government, where individual people who would otherwise protest or who may still protest can go for advice. And you have this whole community of literally, like when I say community, I literally mean just, I have a friend who knows a guy who knows this lady who does XYZ or who has experience doing XYZ. And it's become a very real way of getting what you want and need in an authoritarian regime. And so before anything else, before violent revolution, before system overhaul, before, you know, we march on Westminster and seize the parliament, whatever, what we need to be doing as politically disenfranchised, enraged Brits is we need a community. Like, that's literally the beginning and all of this, at the beginning and end of all of this. Like, what are we supposed to be doing if we're not able to help each other to advocate, you know? Like, you talked about medical misogyny. Well, how do we know that medical misogyny exists? Like, I know that personally, even here in Germany, which is a very progressive semi-socialist state, like there are social policy here is phenomenal. Like, the support I've received as a mother is incredible, which is also convenient because, you know, the German state is quite conservative. They want women to be reproducing. That's like the thing they like. But at the same time, the women's healthcare system in Germany is appalling. It is like, I have been shocked by how awful it is. And I didn't have a language to express that because I didn't really know how to come to terms with the idea that abortion is illegal in Germany. You know, how am I supposed to understand that? How am I supposed to understand that I'm expected to pay out of pocket? My insurance, so the national insurance in Germany, doesn't cover contraception. I would have to pay 350 euros for a coil in Germany. Like, how am I supposed to make health decisions for myself when finance is like part of that decision? It's appalling. And I wouldn't know anything about that unless there were communities of women and people with uteruses who were organizing, advocating, speaking to local policymakers, making change and making noise. You know, if there wasn't this community existing, I wouldn't know how to go about advocating for myself at my lady doctor, is the translation. You know, I would have no idea. And now I can comfortably go to my lady doctor and say, I have a lump in my boob that I'm worried about. I need you to do a scan of it, and I will not pay for it because there is a lump. And normally you would have to pay to have an ultrasound on your boobs, just to, if you wanted to just check on a regular basis. And I would have no language for that. I would have no means of speaking up on my own behalf if this community didn't exist. So until we have some kind of community, I know you joked about this, half joked about this in some of your posts on TikTok about forming an alternative media, you know, but genuinely, that's what we need. We need a community who know how the system works, who have advocated before, not that they have degrees in British policy or whatever, but people who have literally just been involved in trying to get what they need from a system because they have needs. If you have someone who's had a 0 hours contract and who knows how hard it is to get paid for your holiday with a 0 hours contract, I have 5 years of being on a 0 hours contract in the UK that I didn't get holiday pay for, and I have no idea where to start to try and get that back. 5 years of like working 8 to 2 hours weeks, and I have no idea how to get that. Where's the community? Where can I go? And these communities exist, then it's not that they're not there. It's just, I don't know as an individual how to get to them. And the Chinese are fucking smart. They know where to go. They know that the only way that they're gonna get what they want and need is through their personal relationships with people. Sometimes that's corruption. Sometimes this comes as, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. But when we're talking about normal people, everyday people, the only way that we can get what we need is by talking to other people like us. And if they're not represented in our government, which I don't know about you, but they're not, we're going to have to rely on ourselves. And that's how you navigate living under a de facto authoritarian system. Let's just do that.
This is the thing. Like, this is what I wanted. This is what I needed. Like, this is exactly the kind of conversation I want to be having. Because one of the things that I've noticed, and I will absolutely admit to, is I'm just some random guy who lives in Leeds who is politically disenfranchised, but wants to collaborate and get involved and change the system. So all I do some days is I pop up on the internet and I go, I'm unhappy with this and it's bad. Okay, bye. And it's like, that doesn't, it doesn't necessarily help. Of course, it does, it lays the seed, and that's what I've realized I'm doing. So I don't feel bad for those videos where people tell me I'm moaning, because I'm laying the seed of, are you guys unhappy about this? Because if loads of people come on my comments and go, I feel the same. You know, the video that I did that went crazy about the cost of living increases. If you put the version on Facebook, the versions on Twitter, and the version on TikTok together, that has been seen 2.7 million times in the world. And to those people that are based in the UK and that watched it and didn't just scorn me or, you know, make fun of me or whatever, and genuinely felt the same, to those people, I'm like, right, we have a consensus, don't we? You don't like this. You are annoyed by this. That's the first thing. Let's start talking about how we're unhappy. Then we can talk about how we want to address it. Of course, some people are like, overthrow the Tories. And I'm like, it just doesn't work that way, because people will suffer if that happens. If you want to be a decent human being, you need to start with the least radical option and work your way up. Make a community. Talk about what you want. Formulate a consensus. And then move forward with that consensus to the people in charge. If you aren't listened to, then it becomes a matter of escalation, and it doesn't have to be protests and riots and violence or my, you know, we can talk about general strikes. We can talk about specific, like shutting down specific industries and saying, you want this? Well, you have to do this first. This is the point.
Boycotting. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Citizen action is so possible. But we just don't really have that knowledge. Like, we see, a lot of us see protest as the only way to get anything done. But even protest is so heavily eingeschränkt. Like, there are borders to what you can actually do. Like, there's limits placed on what you can actually do when you're thinking about protest. Yeah, like when you have something that's as obvious a political participation method as protest, and even that has such fixed limits placed upon it. You know, it's difficult to try and figure out where to go or what you want, or even if there's kind of a market, to speak in neoliberal terms, like, is there a market for your complaint? And if we're all sat here shaming ourselves for having complaints at all, shaming other people for complaining about stuff, how are we supposed to know that there's a market for your complaint? How are we supposed to know that there isn't already a community that shares your exact problem? How would I know in Germany that there was a whole village here of women that I've been friends with for years who have struggled trying to get the coil, or struggled with problems that came after having got the coil, how painful it is, but they didn't want to take it out because, you know, it's a waste of €350. How would I have known that that existed? This immediate community on my physical, literal doorstep. How would I have known that that didn't exist if I hadn't complained about my doctor trying to sales pitch the coil to me and being like, it's only €350, and then 5 years of not stressing about whether or not you get pregnant? You know, like, how would I have known that there's an entire community suffering from the same thing? Oh, and coil TikTok is a whole different animal, like, because people are talking about it, because getting the coil is fucking disgusting. It hurts. People are having periods for months on end. It's horrific. You know, how would I have known about that if people weren't openly complaining about this very real, very painful issue?
I think as well, though, this is the point. This goes far beyond the borders of Britain, and it's something that really bugs me. Not being passionate about things that don't affect you, you know? Like, one of the key things that I, like, genuinely have had this, I had to delete it off of the post about medical misogyny, was, she's not going to fuck you, bro. And I was like, I'm gay, bro. Like, sometimes people just care about other people. I get it with, I literally had someone in the, you know, I only really became aware of just how much people of color suffer in their daily lives from microaggressions and stuff, because, to my shame, because of BLM, even though I have friends of color. And I just didn't know that they went through that and didn't talk about it. And we saw that community emerge from that. And I get people being like, why, or if, not recently, but I had people at first being like, why do you care? You're not black. And I'm like, because I'm not a dickhead. You know, it's the same. Probably the most common thing that I get asked on Twitter in particular is, are you trans? Because I care about trans issues. It's like, no, like, I'm not a woman. I'm not trans. I'm not a person of color. I just give a shit about human beings. You know, I just want us all to realize that human beings are well within their rights to live in peace and dignity. They're allowed to have these feelings and talk about them. And it's not a case of, you know, I want, it's not a transactional thing. I just look at the world holistically. One of my favorite things that ever happened was Elliot Page, before he transitioned, he was, when he came out, in his coming out speech as a lesbian, there's this one bit that's just stuck with me for years, and I literally replay it in my head every now and then, where he goes, the world would be a much better place if we could just stop being horrible to each other for 5 minutes. And honestly, I heard those words, and from that day, something woke up in me that went, I don't need to understand what it's like to be non-binary, to be a woman, to be a person of color. I don't need to understand those things to know that every single person in those groups has the right to live with dignity, with protection, to be happy, to be safe, to be looked after. You don't need to understand someone to know that they have value. And we need to get everybody out of that type of thinking. And from that, because what that comes from, what you've said about, you know, like having to pay for women's healthcare and stuff, it's insane. Why, like, and men, why aren't men annoyed about it? Like, if, like, selfishly, it affects them too, because do you want a child before you're ready to have a child? But also, do you want the people that you share the street with and your home with, your life with, do you want them to suffer?
And literally suffer, because if you get an IUD and it doesn't work for you and you don't take it out because you want to pay, you don't want to have to lose the money, that is physical suffering. That is like operation level pain that you just deal with because you're a woman and the system doesn't give a shit about you. Like, how awful is that? You talk about selfishness, and I disagree with you a little bit. I think selfishness is really useful. We talk about this selfishness, and I think selfishness is super useful because you have things that upset you in your life. You have things that cause you physical pain. You have things that is shit for you, and you need to talk about them. Like, that's literally it. Like, that you need to be able to voice these complaints and have other people be like, oh yeah, I totally get it, this completely separate thing happened to me and it pissed me off too. Like, yes. How good are we at doing that as British people? We are so good at bitching about our lives, you know. We need to be doing it. Like, this is political activism, literally sitting there not having to be a woman, not having to be gay, not having to be anything other than who you are, and bitching about it. Like, I sat there and complained about my very specific situation as an immigrant who comes from a country where there is universal healthcare, where since the age of like 15, I have been getting the pill for free. I got free checkups for everything. You know, I come from that context that is wildly different from the context of my friends here. And yet we sat in a room together and we bitched about the things that didn't work for us right in that moment. I didn't have an IUD in. I have never had an IUD. I have no idea what it feels like to get an IUD. But I can sit there and be like, oh my fucking God, this is shit. And then talk about a completely different subject that also affects me and be like, this is also shit. And that community of complainers and moaners and people who are just not happy with something, that is radical. To be able to sit in a room with people with completely different views from you, with completely different backgrounds, from completely different demographics, to be able to sit together and just bitch about all the things that piss you off without thinking that one thing is bigger than another person's thing, or without necessarily having to engage in the conversation of, I have this thing and it's, you know, a little bit more important than your thing. And, you know, this kind of Olympics, what do you call it? Like privilege Olympics, whatever the right wingers decide to label this as. That's not a bad thing at all. Be selfish, bitch about the things that upset you, engage in conversations with people who maybe aren't affected by that. Let them know that it's a thing. I had this conversation with my partner, who is a cis man. He didn't even realize that you had to pay for this kind of stuff in Germany. Neither of us realized that abortion was illegal here. It just wasn't something that came up on our radar, because until quite recently, we'd never thought to need it. And if people who did need an abortion and had to go to the obligatory 3 counseling sessions could only get it done before 12 weeks, you know, if people had gone to that and been through it and needed to complain about it and had complained about it, we would know. And if people are shaming themselves for complaining, we are all suffering because of it. Bitch, Britain, bitch. That's how you engage politically.
Thanks for listening to Politically Enraged, a podcast designed to discuss politics palatably. If you're interested in following us on social media, you can find me at Davy Moo pretty much everywhere. And you can also find us on Instagram at Politically Enraged, where you can see the blog. You can find us on Ko-fi in case you'd like to caffeinate me. And you can find us on Twitter at Political Rages. Thanks for tuning in. And remember, stay politically engaged and get politically enraged. Because remember, we deserve better.